Yeah, I found that hard to believe. I thought she would have kicked Salver's ass, frankly.
Yeah, she should have been far more formidable. I completely agree with you there.
Yeah, take away her eye and she's got nothing left.
Well, maybe that's the problem. You know, yeah, she doesn't have no depth perception. She doesn't have no peripheral vision. Welcome to season two of Star's End, a podcast dedicated to Foundation, Isaac Asimov's classic science fiction series. Both the books and the TV series currently streaming on Apple TV+. In season one, we read through the three books of Asimov's original Foundation series with an enthusiastic but critical eye. Now we've turned that eye to our screens to watch and discuss the show. I'm John, and I'll be one of the voices guiding you through this story of the fall and rise of galactic empires.
I'm Dan. We're Foundation fans who love the novels but aren't afraid to critique them. We're hoping to love Apple's new series and aren't afraid that it's an adaptation that changes some things. But if we see something that rubs us the wrong way, we'll let you know.
My name is Joseph. You joined us on our nostalgic journey through this 80-year-old classic. Now join us on a new adventure as we see whether galactic civilization and this new interpretation of Asimov's story will evolve or die.
This week, we get episode 5 of the Foundation TV series. We're going to take a look back at the story so far and a couple of points from previous episodes that we'd like to cover. But first, we have a special guest, Joel McKinnon, the host of the Selden Crisis podcast, a podcast 100% fully endorsed by this podcast. But rather than giving Joel a big introduction, I'm going to let you take over and tell us about yourself and tell us about the Selden Crisis podcast. And anything else that you've got kind of on the burner.
My pleasure. And I am just incredibly honored to be on your podcast. I'm a huge fan. I've checked out, I think I've listened to every minute of every one so far. Took me a little while, but loved the recap of the core trilogy. It was really well done. I learned a lot and it was kind of funny. My podcast was a little bit ahead of yours for a while when I first discovered, you know, or maybe it was just catching up to it, listening to it. But eventually what really was kind of nice is that you guys covered books that I hadn't gotten to yet, especially The General and The Mule. And I just loved those episodes, some really insightful stuff in there. And I think I used some of it in my podcast, possibly a little bit.
You're welcome to appreciate any of it. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I appreciate the insight. And that's one of the things I've just loved about listening to you guys. It's just the obvious deep love for the source material. You know what you're talking about. So it's great to listen to it. So I'll talk about myself just a tiny bit. I'm from Western Pennsylvania near Pittsburgh. Gradually moved all the way to California. Started a rock band with a couple of friends. And we played for a few years. I was a bass player. I still play a little bit, but not in a band. And I actually still make a little bit of music. I made, wrote a rock opera a few years ago. I'll talk about that real briefly. It's called Planet and Sky, and it's a science fiction story. Very kind of unique to the point of being hard to market and package for consumption. One of those like way too indulgent kind of my own thing to the point of like I no compromise. And so it didn't go, I'd say it didn't go gangbusters in sales or anything like that as a rock opera. So then I made it into a podcast, my very first podcast, and got a ringer, a guy named Doug Metzger to do the narration. He does a great podcast on Anglophone literature called Literature and History. And he did the whole reading of it, which was great. It's out there, planetandsky.com. You can check it out. And so last summer, I started rereading Foundation for the first time since I was a teen, about 40 years ago. And I decided that this time I was not going to just do the core trilogy. but do all the books. And then I went back and did the two Robots books I hadn't read. So I've now got all of the Robots and Empire books, all the Robots and Foundation books. I still haven't read the three Empire books. So those are still waiting. But after finishing the seven Foundation books, I just couldn't let go of Asimov. I felt like I had to share it. I first shared it with my son, Jeremy, who is still in the house. And he loved it, absolutely ate up everything. It was wonderful bouncing ideas back and forth off of him. And I thought, wow, I kind of want to go farther with this. So I decided to come up with a podcast. And that was before knowing about the Apple TV Foundation TV show. So that's just a happy accident. Selden Crisis can be found at seldencrisis.transistor.fm. I've already mentioned planetonsky.com. You can find me on Twitter at Joel G. McKinnon. And that's probably all you need from me.
We'll put all of those links in the on our site, right, Joseph?
Absolutely.
That's great. I don't know if you, speaking of music, I don't know if you were able to experience Dan's wonderful rendition of Freebird, which was up on Twitter for about 5 minutes before he took it down. But it was.
You must send me that, Dan. I have to listen to that.
Only if you swear to delete it after listening.
Absolutely. I've made many such false swearings before.
So you're now up to, you're in the middle of the mule story on.
That's right. Yeah. I've gotten as far as the mule, and the general was in two parts. That was the first chapter that I had to break out into two parts. I'm breaking the mule out into three parts, and the mule part one was so much fun because I'd been wanting to be Magnifico for the longest time. That was just my dream. And I finally got to be Magnifico on the beach meeting Beta and Torin. It was just a wonderful story to do. And I managed to get a female voice actress to join me. So now I don't have to do all the dozens of voices that are in any Asimov story and try to keep them separate enough so that they sound like different characters. At least I don't have to be a woman, which is, I did have to be in the fifth one, in The Merchant Princes. I was Lysia, the Comdora.
Right.
But I am so glad I don't have to be Beta. And hopefully I won't have to be Arcady and Lady Kalia and a few others coming
up. I mean, that's one of the biggest differences between our podcast and yours, other than that there's three of us and just one of you, is that your readings, while we did do readings while we were doing the books, we did them pretty straight, whereas you do a little bit more of a dramatic reading.
Yeah, it's just the format that kind of came to me was just to do it my way. I wanted to be a storyteller about it. I wanted to bring these stories as stories, but I also wanted to make it about how they relate to me and how I think they're still relevant to society at large. And with this TV show, I'm feeling like that's more and more what Goyer's going for too, is this feeling of like that it's relevant to our times. Maybe it's his wife, you know, speaking in his ear on that. I'm not sure.
I know, but I agree. I think he is pretty explicitly referencing things that are happening now. I think we've noticed that, whether it's climate change or the kind of overreaction to the destruction of the Star Bridge that led the Empire to destroy or to decimate Anacreon and Thespis, and the analogy that has to 9/11 and our reaction and invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, or Afghanistan and Iraq.
Right.
But it does seem like there is a strong current events kind of thread there for Goyer. We'll talk about it, but I mean, we're all kind of wondering how close he's going to stay adhered to the themes of the book. There's some evidence that he is, some evidence that he isn't. It's, we don't know. And it's a lot of fun finding out.
But, I agree. I love the surprises that are coming along with it not following the story exactly. If it had followed the story beat for beat through the whole thing, I'm thinking it could have gotten a little boring, you know, because we know it so well.
You know, as we'll go on about endlessly, the books are very dialogue heavy, not so, and the characters are, even the best characters in the books are not very well developed, and it's hard to do TV that way, especially these days where everything's based on strong characters, character relationships, and action rather than dialogue, although that's not just TV nowadays, that's everything always. I mean, Asimov really gets away with a lot of very dialogue-heavy fiction because that's what he liked to do. I mean, there's, you know, courtroom scenes and conversations between people in rooms together about things. It's true.
That's right. That's yeah. right. I've taken great fun in pillaring Louis Perrin or Pyrene. I still want to call him Perrin because I did for so long. But there's somebody on Twitter who keeps speaking for Louis Perrin, and I have to fight back. And
I'm pretty sure that Star's End podcast account tweet about what a hero Louis Perrin actually is came from Dan, who is our resident Encyclopedia Galactica.
I suspected that. In fact, I didn't have much trouble finding Dan's voice in that at all.
Yeah, he's a misunderstood hero. I'm telling you guys, just wait and see.
Yeah, we get the Encyclopedia Galactica, and it has an entry for sundial, but not one for water clock.
But it has a working sundial comes with the encyclopedia. all right. Well, why don't we turn then to the show, and talk about what we've had so far coming up to episode 5, things in the first 4 episodes, just very quickly. To recap, the first episode really did follow, we all thought followed the books fairly closely. We meet Gal Dornick, we meet Harry Seldon, they get arrested, there's a trial, they get exiled to Terminus. We do meet the very interesting character of the Emperor and the clones of the Emperor, which was a new thing. But for more or less, the opening episode follows the opening chapter of the books. And then we get the trip to Terminus, which Asimov more or less handled completely offstage with here we are now on Terminus and here we are on the ship. We get the very odd and interesting conversations about pregnancy and what to do about it and relationships between Rach and we see the relationship between Rach and Gale developing. And then the shocking scene at the end of the episode where Rach murders Harry, apparently, and sends Gale off in an escape pod. You know, huge cliffhanger. And then we move to the third episode, which was called The Mathematician's Ghost. And we were very disappointed that there was no ghost in the episode. What can you do? In the first half of the episode, we get a lot of insight into the various Kleons as we watch Brother Dusk reaching the end of his life. And actually getting vaporized at the end of his life so that the new Brother Dawn, who is now a baby, can be brought in. We get some hints that there's something about that baby that's odd or different. We haven't really found anything out about that yet. We go back to the other half of episode 3, which takes place on Terminus. We meet Salvar Hardin. We meet a few other characters on Terminus. We see how hard life on Terminus is. At the end of the episode, we see the Anacreons landing. Salvar Hardin has a bow and arrow pointed at her. Episode 4 then switches between the Emperors and Terminus as we see the now sort of, what would you say, late teenager Brother Dawn, some odd behavior, an apparent suicide attempt. We see conflict between Brother Day and Brother Dusk. That gets developed quite a bit. And we see things happening on Terminus with Salvar Hardin capturing Farah, the Grand Huntress of Anacreon, the interrogation, the soldiers appearing, the Anacreons have a big gun. And then at the end of the episode, we get double cliffhanger where the Anacreons are saying, we are going to burn Terminus City to the ground. And we also see Gal Dornick being rescued by some sort of a ship. And that takes us to the end of episode 4. Now, there were a couple of things that we were confused about from those episodes. One of them is this question of the navigation beacon. And Dan, you had some comments about that.
Yeah, so this is something to which we, in good journalistic fashion, owe a quasi-correction to our listeners. Those of you who were paying attention last week will remember that we were complaining that the Anacreonians showed up and wanted a navigation beacon, and we were asking very reasonably, how did they get there if they didn't have any navigation skills? And a couple of our followers on Twitter pointed out reasonably that on the official Foundation podcast, in which David Goyer was speaking, it was explained that Anacreon is actually in the same system as Terminus, and that therefore they wouldn't need a navigation beacon to get there, but they might need that to get to other systems. I actually did listen to that podcast. I didn't hear it. I probably just missed it. I don't doubt it was there. So, you know, that kind of explains, I guess, what the producers were thinking, or the writers. So that's kind of on us that we didn't notice that. But
did they say anything about that in show?
That's the thing, is that
I've been very ambiguous about the geometry of this whole system, everything involved here.
It's more the show's fault or the writer's fault if they kind of left that unclear, like, because you can't have something as a plot point in the show which you then have to go to your own podcast to explain it and give the answer. So that seems to me like they should have kind of put that in the show, because I rewatched and there was nothing. There was nothing about Anacreon and Terminus being together in the same system. So
right,
that's a surprise.
Now, I'm wondering if that was misdirection from the show podcast, because I don't remember it in the show podcast, and I thought I listened to all of them.
I
do remember the part where Goyer admitted he didn't know the difference in how far it would. What the distance from Terminus to Anacreon and Themis was. And then he said, oh no, but they're both, Anacreon and Themis are in the same star system. Or maybe that's what I misunderstood, and maybe he was trying to say they're all in the same star system.
I think the takeaway is that it's a mess and we're still confused.
Mm-hmm. I do think though that in show, Farah more or less admitted that what she's trying to do is draw the Empire out.
Right.
And
right.
As we see that followed up in episode 5. Joel, there was one thing that you mentioned in your short podcast episode about the show, which I did not pick up from the show, which was that Hugo is supposedly 75 years old and has been due to time dilation. And was that in the show?
Yes.
Yeah, it was.
I missed it completely.
Yeah, it was due to his his trips to various star systems, and if he's only going to Anacreon and Terminus, and they're all in the same star system, I guess he goes to other systems as well. Apparently,
yeah,
he must have a navigation beacon.
Yeah, honestly, if that's the answer, that's a very unsatisfying answer. The idea that you know, three, I'll use the Star Trek terms, class M planets are in the same solar system, seems like it must be infinitesimal. I would rather they screwed up and didn't think about how they couldn't navigate there.
They probably should just like wave their hands over that one and let it go into the past and not worry about it. Joseph, you had one also that you wanted to talk about, I think.
Well, because we completely missed it last time, the and I'm blanking on the character's name, but applying that quote. Applying the Salvor, the quote that we all know from Salvor Hardin, violence is the last refuge of the incompetent, to Salvor's dad in the show, and Salvor calling it a, what is it? That's an old man's philosophy or something. You know, I understand that this is a new character, but to be repudiating the old character that directly and that strongly didn't sit right with me, and I think at least we should address it.
I wonder what the purpose is of repudiating something from the book so directly.
One thing Goyer says in his AMA that was interesting to me is that this is not tracking the same way, like that we're seeing the first Salden crisis on Terminus, but it's not in the life of Hardin. It's different. That this is happening when Hardin is like 20 years old instead of when he's 30 or 40 years old. where, however old he appears to be at the beginning of the Encyclopedist, and that in that time he's changed, or she in this case, has changed from her earlier, you know, firebrand, let's use violence if we have to let's be crafty about it.
I mean, fair enough, Joel, but, you know, in the book, Hardin does say that as a young man as well.
I mean, I think he also, however, says, let's use guns. We need to use guns. So, yeah, he's, I looked at those two things and they're not as contradictory as they seem in the book. He's saying, let's use guns because we have to in the first instance. And in the second, he's saying that it's I think the distinction is violence or force, you know, and he's speaking more like violence is like kind of stupid, unthought out force. Whereas, you know, sometimes you have to use force intelligently, and he understands that.
Using guns as a bluff isn't violence.
Right.
I mean, they're two. They could be very distinct things. Mm-hmm. I don't think in the book that there was a single shot fired in that coup that he staged, but that all happened off screen, so I don't remember.
As so many,
and not really a shot fired in the mayor's either, mm-hmm. Right? I think a lot of very close to shots fired and worse.
You know, given all the ways in which the show is placing a lot of heavy emphasis on character development, I would definitely bet on this being a character arc, which Salver Hardin is going to grow into accepting that as her own motto eventually. Maybe that's not this season, maybe that's next season, but I would be very surprised if this is the simple repudiation of this stands and that she's going to be like Rambo going forward.
And that takes us up to episode 5, which unfortunately does not take us to Trantor at all and our various Cleons, which I have to admit my personal favorite part of the show so far has been Lee Pace and his temper and his overall demeanor. I can't get enough of the middle Cleon, but we didn't get any of the middle Cleon in this episode. We kind of got a split story between Gale trying to figure out what the heck's going on the ship that has thawed her out. We do get confirmation that she's been in stasis for about 35 years. And so all of the Gale Dornick parts of the show are taking place contemporaneously with what's going on Terminus. So that was one of the questions that we had from the previous week. Those scenes of Gale on the ship are interleaved with scenes on Terminus as things begin to escalate with the Anacreons. I'm not going to go shot for shot, but at some point they bring Farah to the main tower and she manages, through use of a false eye, which is actually a bomb, to disable the defenses and the Anacreons attack. Meanwhile, Gale's having a lot of trouble on the ship because she doesn't have authorization for anything. Apparently all the authorization was with Raich. And we get quite a science montage of Gale trying to figure out where she is. I have to admit, it was somewhat reminiscent to me of scenes from the book in which various people are actually trying to navigate through using star charts and where are we and how far is it? And you see her triangulating on things and using a lot of heavy mathematics and I guess a knowledge of astronomy that she has in order to try to figure out where she is, where she's going. A lot of fun, I guess, if you're into astronomy, if you're into mathematics. I wasn't sure exactly how it advanced the story. I mean, we knew that Gale was a savant pretty much anyway, mathematically. So seeing her able to do all this was certainly no surprise, as fun as it kind of was to watch. Ultimately, she has to go outside in order to get a good look at the actual stars to see where she is, and through a series of calculations and eyeballing the actual stars that she sees, she realizes she's on her way to Helicon, which is Harry's home planet. And she has figured out that everyone believes that she was in on the murder of Harry, and so she might not be very welcome on Helicon. Meanwhile, over at Terminus, we see the arrival of Lord Dorwin, and I was sad to see Lord Dorwin blown up by the Anacreon, so it didn't come as a huge surprise. Pretty much as that Imperial ship was hovering over the battlefield with that giant gun pointing at it, it kind of figured that wasn't going to be good for Lord Dorwin. But I think Lord Dorwin's a favorite of ours. And
I wasn't even concerned about Lord Dorwin. I was worried about his snuff box.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, I don't think his snuff box is going to be recoverable from that. I guess one of the things that was sort of interesting to me about all that, and we've sort of talked about it before, is that there is as yet really no hint of one of the main story points in the book about Terminus being technologically ahead of everybody. Certainly they have a shield, but it's a citywide shield. They don't have technology. They look like a frontier outpost that barely has any technology. And the Empire is coming with their technology. The Anacreons, who were bombed seemingly literally back to the Stone Age, have their technology. The Foundation doesn't really seem differentiated there. So I guess they're going a different way with this crisis. At the end of the episode, there's utter chaos on Terminus. I don't know how many people have been killed, if any. It doesn't look like the Anacreons are using non-lethal weapons.
Yeah, but also it doesn't look like they're very good shots either.
They have a sort of a stormtrooper aim thing going on there. But
I immediately caught up on that, and I was so happy to read in Goyer's AMA about how that was not intended. That was a result of COVID, actually, because they meant to have many more extras in the scene and they meant to have a lot of stunt falls and things. So some of those shots were supposed to at least hit people. But because of they got all the extras they needed for the Anacreon people, but not for the people they were shooting at.
That's fascinating. But so at the end of the episode, Terminus City appears to be in flames. The Imperial ship has been destroyed. Gale is desperately trying to stop her ship from taking her to Helicon. I'm just going to opine for a second, and then I'll leave things open to everybody else. I really felt like this episode was a little bit of a story bridge episode. It didn't seem to me that the story was advanced very far, either in the story of Gale or in the story of Terminus. I'm not sure what we learned this episode that we didn't already know or that we had to know in order to move forward. And again, if I have a complaint, it's that in a series that has a 10 episode season, I am not sure about their use of screen time here. What have they accomplished in this episode? I'm left wondering, and I'll leave it open to you guys.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of what they a lot of what they've accomplished is just gratuitous, right? I don't understand. I mean, we take Gale's situation, for example. I don't understand the point of having the computer griefing her. It's stupid. You know, they got this outpost set up, you know, that you're going to have, you've got someone there who is certainly an ally. Why put all these obstacles in her way? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, maybe the ship was expecting Raish, other than to showcase how smart Gale is. Yeah, I think John, you're right. I think it didn't accomplish anything.
No, I did leave out, I'm sorry to say, this is going to wreak havoc with the podcast, the first part of the episode, which was Gale's early life, in which we see her very dogmatic religious upbringing. We see her meeting an instructor who is defying the authorities and continuing to study and tells her that she should too. And we see him rather brutally executed by being thrown off a dock with his books and some rocks attached to his feet. And that seems to be the turning point for Gale, that at that point she's had it and has decided to study. And again, while that was interesting and gives us some insight into her character, none of that came as a surprise to me. Like I already knew that she was from a planet that where studying was dangerous, where she did it anyway, where she had the prayer stones removed from her face and that she went to Trantor under some duress. So again, while it was good development of Gale's character and it was good TV, I don't know where what we've advanced in the story by spending so much time with that.
Yeah, see, I'm not sure that it was good advance of Gail's character, because I mean, honestly, you know, when she's encountering Saul, or what was his name? Sorn. She was encountering Sorn in the university. I mean, she seemed sort of predisposed toward having that kind of an intellectual mindset. He's trying to remind her of the studies that she had done, and yet she's completely submerged herself in the religion, maybe hypocritically. Right. And then so she sort of half-heartedly tries to get him to leave so that he doesn't get captured, but then sort of throws her hands up and says he's over there as she's walking away, because he doesn't. And I didn't see enough of a change in her. I mean, she stood there while he was executed, you know, just passively. In fact, I think she takes part actually a bit, you know, then to immediately dive down and retrieve the book that he tried to give her. It didn't feel real to me. You know, she's sneaking, you know, she's now sneaking around with the books, and she's not, what almost seemed cowardly. Where she was sneaking around with the books and studying, but she's also trying to hide it and keep it low key. I didn't like it. I came away from this episode with less respect for Gail than I did coming into it. You know, on top of that, it sort of bugged, because we're talking about a gender swapped character there. The way she was comporting herself on that ship seemed like it was feeding into a lot of unfortunate, I mean, and here we are, maybe we're not the ones to talk about that. So it seemed to be feeding into a lot of unfortunate female stereotypes. She has an immediate, you know, meltdown, and then she's not on the ship for very long, and she's attempting suicide because I guess she's so overwrought, and then the ship changes course and that kind of brings her out of it. But I don't know, you gender swap a character and then you lean into the female stereotypes, and I find that kind of a mixed message.
Anybody want to defend poor Gail Dornick on that?
Yeah, I'd like to defend her. I agree that this episode showed a different Gail than we'd seen. I thought it showed more of her character. It showed her, it deepened her, and also maybe confused us about her a little bit. It showed that she's not just this silent super Einstein, like very calm and on track all the time, that has emotions. When I first watched it, my first take on it was similar in that to what Joseph's describing, in that I was thinking, why is she losing it so badly here? Why is she freaking out? Why isn't she using her brain? Why is she rushing at the door and not trying to figure out how the door works? And it was, when I looked back on it, I thought back on it, it made more sense to me, because I remembered how to her, it was only moments since she had been totally traumatized by what was going on. Suddenly she finds herself in a completely locked in a room somewhere that and has no answers. And it seems like, in hindsight, more appropriate for her to be freaking out at that point. And then what I loved about the computer interrogation screen or scene is that she remembered her brain. Uh-huh. That she said, okay, I'm a smart person and I should be able to figure my way out of this. And she then, you know, she had a pretty tough test, which she passed. And it brings back that element of her character we'd already met, the genius, but we also know that she's got these deeper parts of her that, and the scenes on Synax kind of are part of that too, because they show what a tortured and weird life she had on Synax. And I kind of disagree a little bit about that being so strange that she would have to be skulking around with the books and hiding who she was. If you think about Galileo's story, or Bruno's story, you know, the guy who first thought of that, speculated that there were other planets and things outside of the glass shells that everybody thought there were at that time, and ended up being put to death. So there was a lot of very carefulness amongst people with these views, heliocentric views at that time. So I think there's some historical parallel that makes some sense.
Yeah. Fair enough.
And I would also kind of defend her from charges of cowardice in the scene where her instructor is killed. She was very young. She would have had to really put herself at a great deal of risk. And I mean, maybe it is a little bit of cowardice, but I think it's the kind of cowardice that it's hard to hold somebody to the standard of saying you should have been a hero in that situation.
Yeah, and, but it's more, my complaint is more that she seemed to then make a dramatic change in her behavior.
Well, again, I would say, look, it's a traumatic experience. She probably feels terrible about not having spoken up, about not having saved him or tried to save him. And, it could be that if she was already leaning that way, which he seemed to believe was the case, that would be the last straw that would put her over the top, and that she might then say, I should have saved him. I couldn't save him, but now I'm going to, I've had it with these religious people and I'm now going to dedicate myself to, I don't know. It's hard to hold somebody, especially someone so young, it's hard to hold them to that kind of standard. And that, it looks a little hypocritical. It looks a little cowardly, but to me, at least, it looked like the kind of thing that could really happen to someone. I could see myself in that situation and not being strong enough to speak up and say, you can't throw him into you can't drown this guy. It's barbaric. It's wrong. I could see not being strong enough in that situation. But having said all that, I again go back to the idea of, like, we've spent a lot of screen time on this. There have been some moments in the last few episodes where we've spent a lot of screen time. We spent a lot of screen time with the Cleons on the accession of Brother Darkness. I'm not sure what the payoff of all of that is. And now we've spent a lot of screen time on Gale's childhood. We've spent a fair amount of screen time on the Anacreons and the battle in Terminus. Now we're halfway through the first season. There's a lot of work to do in these last five episodes. Now the five episodes is still a fairly good amount of time. Yeah, I feel like they've spent a lot of screen time and not gotten us very far in some cases.
Well, let me take a stab at answering that. Okay. So I think in my reading, I see what you mean, and it's valid. The two halves of this episode are doing two different things. So the Anacreon section of this episode, you're right that it isn't advancing the plot beyond where we saw it had to go. Like everything that played out on Terminus was pretty much foreshadowed in advance sometime last episode in episode 4, but we kind of still have to see it play out, right? So it's not a huge surprise that, the Anacreons had this plan. They were able to take out the tower. They were able to take out Lord Dorwin. God rest his soul. but we had to just see that on screen. So that's that. And that's, just sort of moving where we thought we were going to go with
it's
that.
It's a Goyer special. It's a big explosion.
Yeah. And it was not, I liked it. It was a lovely explosion. To me, the Gale stuff is not much about moving the story forward. It's more about character development, but even more like thematic development. I saw this as being a lot about faith that goes beyond religious faith. So, obviously the title of the episode is The Sleeper Awakens. That's Gale coming back to life. Mm-hmm. It's also like the sleeper is the God figure in her religion. Mm-hmm. And we have a shift, right? We have a shift away from religious faith to other kinds of faith. And I think, for me, Instructor Sorn in the university trying to nab those books, even though he was standing on the side of reason and logic and learning and math, he was still evincing a certain kind of faith in the future. That is, even though Synax was already, it was done for, right? And it was ruined and it was totally under the control of the zealots. He still had a kind of faith in the importance of learning and rationality, which is important and seems to have stuck with Gale. And then Gale, I was kind of moved by her little scene with the hologram of Harry saying congratulations on solving the Abraxas conjecture. It almost seemed like she was getting this validation and almost a kind of faith in herself, which we then see play out in her scene, her scene with the math, doing the math with the computer, that she is remembering that she's got this. She has a good mind, and she can get herself through this situation. So it's kind of, you know, to me, that was really interesting and valuable in this thematic way of thinking about what is faith and how, you know, we're asked to trust in the plan. That's what Rafe says right before he's blown out the airlock. And so, you know, we have to think, it's going to, you know, help us to think about different ways of having faith in the future.
Well, let me then address one thing about the thematic approach here, is that it does seem that at least in the last episode, maybe episode and a half, maybe the last two episodes, we have telescoped down into stories about the individual people, stories about Terminus, the Anacreons, but that the big themes of Foundation are not really being addressed so much. We seem to have focused in very narrowly on the stories of the people, which again, that makes for better TV. But the big themes, whether it's, you know, whether it's the plan and psychohistory, the great man versus bottom-up theory of history, whether it's even the kind of multiple ages of man that the Kleons seem to represent, we seem to be telescoping in from those things into a narrower view. I'm wondering if and when we're going to telescope back out and start again to address the more Asimovian, if you like, the more Asimovian bigger themes that the story that we all came to the story in, you know, that it addresses.
Well, I think they're definitely going to have to do that when they get into the sequels, because then it's all about these giant ideas for the future of humanity, where it's going.
Right. I mean, I'm just wondering where they're going to go this season with the five episodes they've got. As we know, they've got another 10 episodes. They've got the green light for a season two. And we've heard about, we're going to see Hober Mallow. We're going to see the mule. You know, it's a choice, I think, that they make every episode. Are we going to address these overarching themes, or are we going to look at the people, or are we somehow going to fit the people into the overarching themes? You know, we're pretty demanding here. We want perfection. So, take heed, David Goyer. We demand perfection here at Star's End.
You know, this has been my concern all along, right? I think all of us have recognized that TV is a different medium than novels, that Asimov's talky novels would never have translated to the screen directly. And that, you know, the novels, they're not sacred scripture anyway. Like, there's plenty of faults that we found in those when we were discussing the novels. I don't think any of us have been demanding that it be exactly, you know, page to screen. I've always wanted, and I think I've said many times, you know, I want the spirit, right? I want to see the real question of psychohistory being raised. And that eventually has to have a thesis that individual actions don't matter. Now, it doesn't actually require that we come down on the side of that philosophical position. Asimov posits the counter argument to that in his own novels. But it hasn't been voiced very heavily. It's kind of like a theme that's sort of been vaguely introduced. It's sort of floating in the background in some of Gale's voiceovers. So far, we've been seeing a lot of dramatic action by characters that really seems to matter, which is what you'd expect from a big budget action TV show. I'm hoping, and I still have faith in the plan, that Goyer is gonna show the kind of abstracted side of psychohistory. But if so, it's gonna be by a pretty surprising turn, because that's not the way things seem to be going halfway through season one.
Right. I mean, we still have the question of Salvar Hardin's strange relationship with the vault, her ability to call coin flips consecutively, which left us all with lots of questions, and her apparent ability to read minds.
This is a good point, I think, to bring up something that Goyer said in his AMA, which is about the specialness of Salvar Hardin and others. He said, there aren't any chosen ones in the show, but we play with the concept of people feeling like they might be and other people believing they might be. And to me, that was one of the most heartening things I've read him, heard him say, because that was my biggest concern with where things were going with Salvor Hardin's unique abilities to get through the null field and to somehow be, and it was enhanced by the last episode where we saw the momentary vision she had of the Imperial Library and the Mystery Boy. And this makes me think that this is one of those things where there are things happening to her that she doesn't understand. We don't understand either, but there's going to be an explanation at some point that's rational. And I really hope that's the case, but this gives me a lot more confidence in that.
You know, it seems evident that these special abilities are coming from the vault in some way, shape, or form. That almost amounts to being a chosen one, I would think.
But it does kind of lead you to say, well, if it wasn't Salvor Hardin, if Salvor Hardin had never existed, the vault would have chosen someone else.
Okay,
the vault needed someone, but it didn't have to be her. And that's fair enough. I mean, I would love to see the show get back to some of these larger themes that, you know, what the Kleons represent, you know, a lot of questions about the nature of prediction and knowledge about the future. And what does all of that mean? And is it possible? And can you do it? You know, they were kind of still having a debate about whether Harry Seldon was a charlatan or whether his predictions were self-fulfilling. I mean, Farah actually refers to that. Farah is very angry at the Foundationers because she believes that the bad things that happened to Anacreon happened because of Seldon's predictions. And what she's doing on Terminus is getting revenge against Seldon and his project. I thought that was a good point, actually. That was actually, to me, a good part of the story that I hadn't even really realized. I thought she was just using Terminus to get a reaction out of the Empire that she could then kind of give the Empire a black eye. But she's really angry at the Foundation itself. And that is one of the big questions. Is something like Seldon, and Asimov refers to it a little bit too, is something like a Seldon plan just something self-fulfilling? And we've talked about whether, you know, ultimately we've talked about whether Harry or Demerzel is responsible for the destruction of the Star Bridge and the destruction of Anacreon and Thespis. We don't know where the show's going. And I was kind of hoping we'd get a little further along on some of those things, and we didn't. But I fully expect that we will in the next few episodes. So
I'd like to talk about Farah for just a moment.
Let's talk about Farah, our favorite actress.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm really intrigued by her character. And one of the things that really intrigues me is that she's essentially humanizing the Anacreonians in a way, because in the story, in the books, they were really pretty shallow and pretty flat. There wasn't much depth to Muenas or Leopold or Ansulf Haut-Rodrik, the envoy that came to Terminus, right? They were pretty much very straight, that stereotypical characters. And I thought that Asimov showed in the, as Foundation played out, that he could write more complex villainous characters, as we saw with Belriose and the Mule, and even, you know, going back to the Merchant Princes with Commodore Asper and his wife, his wife was kind of a stereotypical shrew, but Asper was not a standard villain. He had some complexity to him. And I think that Farah is really doing that for the Anacreon. She's making Anacreon something that you feel for a little bit, where those people are coming from, what motivates them, which you didn't in the books, really. It was just power. Right, and that was all it was about. So in a way, I think Farah is the second brand new element to this story that isn't in the books. The first being the Kleons, and how well that's been done has been really, you know, talked about a lot. But I think Farah is a similar step into a new artistic creation that works within the universe of Foundation that's being developed, and I really like it.
Yeah, I think she's. You're absolutely right. She's bringing a humanization to the Anacreons. Her story is quite tragic. Her parents, her brother, And, you know, she has a tremendous emotional effect on Salver and on the rest of us. It does make for a good story. And we are interested in Farrah's story and we want to know more about it. I just don't think this episode brought us that much more of it. You know, she shows that she's a better tactician than the people on Terminus. Frankly, I found the least believable thing, the fact that she loses a hand-to-hand fight with Salver. You know, how is that possible? I mean, she's a warrior. Salver is living on an outpost, you know, without weapons. So I found that one a little bit. Yeah, I found that hard to believe. I thought she would have kicked Salver's ass, frankly.
Yeah, she should have been far more formidable. I completely agree with you there.
Yeah, take away her eye and she's got nothing left.
Well, maybe that's the problem. You know, yeah, she doesn't have no depth perception. She doesn't have no peripheral vision. So that was what Salver's able to take advantage of. There's your moment of levity. Well, no, there's a moment of levity. I still think the eye is a good place for that. But Dan, maybe you have something else in mind as a moment of levity. If we're up to that, I don't know. Maybe we can, maybe we're not quite there yet.
Well, maybe before we get there, you want to just go around and everyone give a summary of up or down vote for the season halfway through and why?
I'll go with it if I can add one more comment.
Sure.
That I think might be a little bit, this goes back to Mr. Sorn, that encounter they had in the rising waters within the academy or whatever, where he was explaining about the book, about the, I can't remember the title, Talia's Nine.
The Book of Folding or whatever it was.
Book of Folding, whatever that book is. But he mentioned chaos theory, which really jumped out at me. Uh-huh. Because one of the things that has been a major point of contention that some people have had with Foundation from a modern perspective, I'm not talking about the old book fans like us, but people who are more into like the more modern science fiction, that it doesn't take into account things like chaos theory, right? And that psychohistory really doesn't make sense. And to me, that was interesting because now we have an opportunity to bring chaos theory into psychohistory, right? Because now it's out there and we can talk about it, and maybe that's what they'll do. Maybe that will have some impact on the way psychohistory plays out.
Well, if only we had a mathematician who could comment on this, maybe we
I think possibly way back in our first episode. We talked briefly about the intersection of chaos theory and the potential for psychohistory. And that fundamental observation with the butterfly effect, where I forget the guy's name, possibly Rodriguez. But the guy ran two identical simulations with very, very minor details different. I mean, he like rounded some of the numbers and got a completely different projection out of basically the same data. Yeah, kind of implies that it, you know, there is so much stuff at that granular level that is influencing things that you can't track, that it, makes it hard to believe that you could do predictions on the level of psychohistory. There's certainly some modeling that you could do, but they're much broader brushstrokes, I think.
My understanding of it is that a chaotic system is a system that is so sensitive to initial conditions that you would need to measure the initial conditions of the system beyond our ability to make measurements. And so therefore you can never fully, even in a deterministic system, you can never fully analyze it because we don't have, not just because our instruments aren't good enough, but because there are some measurements that are impossible and that therefore systems become chaotic. And yet, through the use of chaotic concepts, we have actually been able to, for example, improve our ability to predict the weather. Mm-hmm. It's not just that the weather, which is, you know, the classic chaotic system, it doesn't mean that we can't make weather predictions. It does limit some of our ability to make predictions, especially long-term predictions, but also short-term predictions. So I wonder if there, you know, if there couldn't be a way to, despite the sensitivity of the system to its initial conditions, to potentially make predictions within a chaotic system. And again, you know, Asimov is basing his theory on his knowledge of, you know, gas laws, where a chaotic system, but which does respond to statistical analysis. So I'm not sure that chaos theory eliminates psychohistory as a possibility. I'll defer to your judgment, though, Joseph.
I mean, I think at the very least it limits it. I mean, you know, you look at, you know, it's a matter of, I think that's actually an excellent way of looking at it. Our ability to measure things, right? We think of, you know, coin flips as being random, right? But there have been studies done where when they exactly controlled, you know, the direction of the flip and the conditions of the flip and the strength of the flip, and, you know, you control a coin flip carefully enough and it comes up the same way every time. Who's doing the flipping and what's the angle of their, you know, and how high do they flip it, and all of that stuff changes, and so it's random. But ultimately, I think you're right. I mean, you imagine, you know, you're talking about, and I'm going to say individuals here, but you're talking about a galaxy with trillions of individuals in it. Each of them is a potential chaos vector. So yeah, I mean, there I am coming down on the great man side of that argument. But
oh man.
But I mean, you know, every one of them is an initial condition, and how could you possibly quantify all of that? How could you possibly gather that much information?
Yeah, and I think one thing that chaos theory would tell you is that deviations from the plan would multiply exponentially and uncontrollably, that it would be very, very difficult once you deviated from the plan to get back on track.
Mm-hmm. And there you need a second foundation.
You definitely need a second foundation. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, because you don't just need the GPS. You need the radio station telling you there's an accident ahead.
Right. Mm-hmm. To continue a metaphor from a previous
previous
episode of our podcast. Yeah, and I actually thought we were going to get introduced to some version of the Second Foundation in this episode. And I think we all thought that Gale was going to be somehow involved in that. It's still possible. I'm intrigued by why this ship is going to Helicon, by these holograms of Harry, of dying Harry, and pools of blood lying on the floor. I wasn't sure if they were delusions. Gale, I mean, I think Joel is a very good point. In her perspective, she has only just seen Harry murdered. And that was certainly traumatic for her. What is the point of all that? And they're certainly teasing that Harry didn't die.
There's the whole thing about that last scene.
Yeah, there's the whole thing about him being buried in the special coffin that he made himself, not at all suspicious in any way. I kept expecting to see in those close-ups of Harry in the coffin, like his eye twitch or something, you know, to indicate that he was actually still alive. So is Harry still alive? And is he still alive 35 years later? And what about Rach? Rach was thrown out an airlock. Now, I know we saw a character in The Expanse survive a trip out of an airlock, but you would not have a lot of time being shot out of an airlock if you could survive it at all. So Rach seems pretty dead to me. But yeah. Harry, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think my bet is Harry is very much alive, and I bet that he's on Helicon waiting for Gale to arrive.
I guess but, so, though he's quite old.
That's a good point. Yes, he would be dead by now anyway, in theory.
Well, unless he did some time dilation travel like Hugo seems to have done.
Maybe he did. That specially designed coffin was also had some properties, much like Gale's, whatchamacallit. I never did give my thumbs up or down. I'm going to give a thumbs up on this episode because I think that it did answer a lot of hanging things about the murder, or at least furthered our understanding of what happened at that time. We know how things played out after it. I think we got a much better sense of where things are going with Gale and Harry. We got the conclusion of the big fireworks on Terminus, but there's still, the crisis is not necessarily resolved. And I guess I don't feel quite as impatient as some on like resolving these unanswered questions. I'm thinking of this more in terms of 80 episodes than just 10. And I'm thinking, I'm not sure if that's something that the public appreciates as much as I'm appreciating the idea of a long game on this, of it really playing out over quite a long period of time. I know that they are going to have to make it. People want to come back and watch season 2. So I think there's going to be a lot of resolution happening in the last few episodes that are going to tie up a lot of loose ends and probably present some very big enigmas to consider for season 2. But I think it's going along pretty well, and I really like this episode.
Fair enough. I mean, I am very anxious to see the next episode. While I think the word impatient is a very good one, that I am very impatient and did not feel like they satisfied my impatience enough in episode 5. There is no doubt I will be glued to the TV to watch episode 6. I like a lot of what they've done. If we take the half season in total, I'm having a very good time with the show and very much want to see where they go and when they return, as I think they will, to the larger themes, which I agree, Joel, that you have to look at the larger themes on an 80 episode arc. You know, they have to resolve the short-term stuff within the season. I do not expect them to resolve the greater questions, but I do expect them to continue to try to ask those questions. And there's some very interesting questions that they've begun to ask, and they've got me intrigued. So I'm certainly hooked on this show. And as I always say on here, my litmus test for the show or any show is, do I want to see more of it? And the answer is absolutely yes. I'm dying to see more of it. I wish they would have a shorter gap in between episodes. So, I mean, I give the whole thing a thumbs up, even if my impatience is showing in my analysis of episode 5. Joseph?
Yeah, so definitely thumbs up for the first 5 episodes. Probably have to give a thumbs sideways to this one. Because they went places with a female character that just didn't ring true to me, and would have gone with a male character. And they spent a lot of time telling us what they were going to do and then doing it, and that made the episode a lot less interesting than it could have been. And the whole thing with the computer griefing Gale just, you know, was silly.
Dan, did you ever answer your own question, or did you just leave it open for the rest of us?
Oh, yeah, no, I didn't. So I'll say that I'm very happy. I'm giving the thumbs up. These first 5 episodes are definitely not perfect, but it's strong. Like, as an opening for a new epic sci-fi series, considered on its own, especially and without relation to the books, it's very strong. There are a couple of problems. It's a little too thorny. There's a little, like, not this episode, but the first 2 or 3, it's very busy. There's a lot of things going on. There are some things that are confusing and may have alienated some people. I feel like I would, you know, even with the caveat that, you know, lots of changes needed to be made to the books to make it filmable, I wish that it had been just a little closer to the books, not even for my own sake, but just because there's a lot of people out there who wanted something a little closer, right? And are kind of annoyed that there's a lot of new elements. It would have been nice to sort of bring everybody along. And I'm not talking at all about people who are complaining that this is too woke or whatever. That's a garbage take and I don't care about it, but I think it's not unreasonable that some people, if you love a property and you get excited about it being brought to the screen and then you see something really different, I understand why some people are alienated. So I think I would have liked it to be just a little, a few fewer new elements to start the season. And that's my only complaint. But apart from that, you know, just considered purely as its own thing and its own show, I think it's really great, and it's telling a lot of interesting stories and doing interesting things on the framework of Asimov's Foundation.
Imagine trying to read the books when you're watching this. I'm not sure. I think there's a lot of people who would go 2 chapters in would be like, what in the world is this?
Yeah.
I can't read this. Joel, yeah, any final thoughts about this before we go on to our moment of levity? And
No, I think I have one too. No, I think it's great. I'm just love that 100 times more people will know about psychohistory when this is all over and might know something about it. Asimov and his works will just get so many more readers. And I think you're right that many of them will probably stop 2 chapters in and say, this isn't what I wanted. This isn't anything like as cool as that show. And a few others will say, this is what that show should have been about. This is what they should have done. This is a great story. Why didn't they just do this? But I think that'll be there'll be less of those, you know, but it will bring a lot more interest to the real stories, the original stories over time.
Well, Dan, let's get to the moment of levity.
Well, so my moment of levity, it's sort of been staring us in the face for a long time, but I didn't notice it until this episode. And that is, of course, to do with the hero of the foundation, one Mr. Louis Pirine, director of the Encyclopedia Foundation. And I don't know if you've been paying attention to Louis Pirine's very stylish clothing choices, but on Terminus, he's been wearing this amazing jacket, which it looks like a 1980s designer tried to do something futuristic, somewhere like halfway between Michael Jackson's leather jacket from Beat It and a ribbed condom is kind of the look of this jacket. Okay. I didn't notice this, but when we had the hologram of the Inquisition, or the Inquisition of Raish, and he's having this dialogue with him, Louis Pirine is wearing that same jacket that he is wearing 35 years later.
Man, good jacket.
On Terminus.
Demerzel's been wearing the same dress for 400 years.
Yeah, well, she's a robot. Come on. But Louis Pirine, and I admit, you know, there's no Banana Republic on Terminus, but you can't, you know, he's not going to have a lot of options, but he really loves that jacket. And I wanted to call him out as having just the most sublimely ridiculous loyalty to that particular piece of clothing. So kind of a tip of my cap and a chuckle to Louis Pirine.
I thought he was a little quick to send Rach out the airlock. I would have pegged Louis Pirine as being a kind of a real anti-death penalty type, you know, who would have put him in the brig for 40 years, but he wouldn't have just shot him out the airlock. I was a bit surprised by that. But
yeah, there's a lot of executions in this show, I gotta say.
There are a lot. Like Brother Day executing people. Yeah. I get it. Louis Pirine, you know, yeah. Like, you know, I don't know. I mean, you guys are in academia. You know more about how that works.
When it comes to the safety and the security of the encyclopedia, there can be no compromise.
Okay, there you go. A little pro death penalty in the interest of saving the encyclopedia. For
absolutely.
Death. Yeah. Right. Yeah, but I'm going to carry forward that Louis Pirine is like Gilligan in his devotion to his fashion.
To be fair, everyone on that trip was very devoted to fashion. Although some of the people had more changes of clothing than you might have expected. All right. Well, listen, I think we've got to wrap it up. I want to thank you, Joel, very much for coming on our podcast. It's great to have another voice, another perspective to take a look at these things. Cause you know, the three of us kind of get a little, it's a little Brother Day, Brother Dawn and Brother Dusk here. We all have the same viewpoint, and it's good to bring someone else in who's got a, you know,
I think one of you is Louis Pirine and not one of the brothers.
I wonder who that could be.
Now, in future,
it's been a blast. I really enjoyed spending some time with you guys. I wish I could do this every week.
Oh, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks. And I get to hear the podcast early.
You do. Yes. The unedited version of the podcast, the warts and all. Although we take a light touch on editing. We take out a lot of ums and ahs, but the content stays pretty much in. Well, in future episodes, we're going to continue to have guests. We're hoping to bring on a special guest who has not read the books, but has been watching the TV show with great interest. Spoiler alert, it's my wife, but that's the prerogative you get when you're running your own podcast. And then
is she a fan yet?
She loves the show. She absolutely loves the show and has not read the books. And actually, I will confess, she has found it very hard to listen to the podcast because she, in its first season where we really just covered the books, because she hasn't read the books. And so I think we had an assumption as we read through the books and talked about them, that that the person listening would probably either have read the books or be reading along with us. And I think it may have been a little confusing for someone who had not read the books and was not reading the books. But she's very much enjoying the TV show and is just as anxious as the rest of us to see the next episode. So we're going to get her perspective in a future episode. And we also have another planned guest who is a Hollywood screenwriter who is going to give us some insight into how adaptations like this work and how science fiction works on the screen. So we'll have more information about that in the future. But in upcoming episodes, we're going to have these guests and potentially other guests as well. I think we like the guest format. And Joel, I think, as our second ever official guest, you've proven the concept for us that we can go ahead and safely bring more guests.
Well, that brings this week's episode to a close. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, subscribe and give us a like and a positive review on your favorite platform.
You can also visit our website at starsendpodcast.wordpress.com, where there's always additional content. Our music, used by a Creative Commons license, is It Is Coming by Alex Mason.
Also, follow us on Twitter at starsendpodcast. Goodbye for now from the galactic capital of Trantor. This is where the stars end.